Some of you may remember this.
Apart from the assault itself, these past couple of weeks have been the hardest of my life. I've had to relive this trauma in front of the world.
Others will also remember this.
Telling the world is the most difficult experience of my life, but it is very close to having to live through the experience that occasioned this meeting.
That was Christine Blasey Ford, followed by Anita Hill, both testifying in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee. But 27 years apart, they alleged sexual assault and sexual harassment against Supreme Court nominees. That sound was from their hearings, and for listeners who might find this content difficult, that's what we'll be discussing now. Anita Hill, now a professor of social policy, law, and women's gender and sexuality studies at Brandeis University, has a new book reflecting on the decades since her testimony and calling for sweeping community action to end gender violence. We spoke with Professor Hill earlier today about her book, Believing, Our 30-Year Journey to End Gender-Based Violence. And I asked her what led her to write this book now and what she hoped to accomplish with it.
Well, first, I want to raise awareness to the urgency of the problem of gender-based violence. And I want to educate people who aren't quite aware that gender-based violence covers a range of behaviors, from bullying in schools to sexual harassment in the workplace to intimate partner violence at home and to rape and sexual assault on the streets.
I was really struck by your choice to define all of that as violence. That strikes me as having, you know, sort of practical implications on a policy level and psychological implications as well. Clearly, you did that on purpose. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, the connections between all of those things came from my experience and my testimony about sexual harassment that I had experienced and that I testified to in 1991, and then hearing from people who connected my experience with their own experience of gender-based violence, including rape and sexual assault victims, including domestic violence victims. So the connection is there. It's there in the minds of victims and survivors. And I wanted to honor their perception of what is going on in our country that we need to address.
So I want to understand that a little more. So you wanted to honor that people experience the full gamut. Obviously, we know when we're talking about rape, sexual assault, we know we are talking about violence. You wanted to honor the feeling of being violated in a violent way across that full continuum of experiences. Do you understand what I'm asking?
Oh, exactly. And I want to add, too, that even when we are talking about sexual harassment, many times people think of harassment as being verbal harassment or environmental harassment in a workplace. But when you look at the case law, as I have, you realize that many times, on many occasions, in the cases that come before the court, this physical abuse, physical groping, sexual assault, and sexual extortion happens. And it's hard, really, once you look at the range of behavior that happens even under the category of sexual harassment, to exclude that. You know, the connection is also in terms of the way the public and sometimes even friends respond to claims of gender-based violence, including harassment and including extreme cases of rape.
Is there any risk in calling, let's say, verbal sexual harassment and including it in the realm of gender-based violence? Is there any risk that that will suppress reporting, that people, you know, you talk about women who have spoken up and people of any, all genders who have spoken up being told it's not that bad. Will people self-edit, well, it wasn't violent, if we broaden that definition?
Well, people are already self-editing, and they are experiencing a violation. And so I don't think that people who have experienced sexual harassment will edit themselves anymore because we are recognizing a range of behavior. In fact, I think people will feel affirmed in the recognition of the connections of all of these behaviors.
One of the things that's really striking in the book is It is full of stories. And when I mean full of stories, I mean every chapter and multiple stories in every chapter. Have you found yourself asked essentially to be a personal collection space of people's stories of gender violence for the last 30 years? And if so, how have you made your way through that? How have you carried that?
Well, the stories are essential because I think they humanize the experience. In some ways, I think people like to distance themselves from categories of behavior as though it doesn't affect them. But when you hear the stories of people who have had experiences that I've described in the book, you realize that this is a very human experience, and it's not something that we should neglect or try to distance ourselves from. It's something that we should realize is happening to our friends, our colleagues at work, people in our families, and that we should really look at it from the point of view of those individuals who have had the experiences.
The breadth and the scope of the picture that you paint, Professor Hill, is damning. It just is. I have to assume we have not progressed as you thought we might after your own experience in 1991.
In 1991, I had expected to hear from people who had experienced sexual harassment. That was my expectation. One of the very first calls that I got after the hearing, I was sitting in my office and an individual called me. I picked up the phone. I was hesitant at first because I had been getting harassing phone calls and threatening phone calls. And this individual started out to me by saying, "You've opened a whole can of worms." And this was a person who described himself as a man who had been an incest victim. And he said that the hearings and the way that the Senate approached me reminded him of the way that his parents approached him when he tried to tell them that he had been victimized. They dismissed his claim and sided with his abuser. And he was working through those issues, and hearing the Senate's treatment of me helped him to understand his parents' reaction, that it wasn't personal, that it was part of our culture. And so this is, you know, certainly not where I expected to be, but the whole can of worms is something that we all have to address. We can't just sort of parse out and deal with this as an issue that it's only related to certain people or only happens occasionally or happens because of a few bad apples. We have to look really with clear eyes at all of what is going on in the world and what we need to do to start to develop solutions to address it.
So I want to put a marker down here, which is that in our time together, I don't want to relitigate 1991. I don't want to relitigate the portions of this history that we've had 30 years to discuss and people have been discussing for 30 years. But there are a couple of pieces of new material in your book that we're getting a chance to hear from you on now, and I do want to touch on those two pieces. And the first is Christine Blasey Ford's testimony about Brett Kavanaugh. You talk about it in the book. I just want to ask you what it was like to be you watching that unfold.
Well, fortunately, the me that was watching that is not the 35-year-old who experienced the hearing of 1991. I even in 2018 had gone through years of working through this problem, understanding the problem in the larger sense, and understanding the problem in terms of how people experience it. But the hearing was different in 2018 for me. You know, clearly something that I had similar experience with. Christine Blasey Ford is her own experience. My experience in 91 is my own experience. But what was striking was that even 27 years after my hearing, there had not been a process in place for Christine Blasey Ford to come into that would allow her to be heard and to be treated fairly. And so, you know, it didn't surprise me entirely. I wasn't surprised. I hoped it would be better. I hoped it would be better in terms of the process. And I hoped it might have a different outcome. But neither of those two things happened.
I'll come back in a minute to that question of process. I do want to pick up one other event from the book. You address President Joe Biden at the end of the book, his apology to you in 2017 for how he handled your hearing. You also said you voted for him because you always ask which candidate will do the most to end gender violence. Have you ever seen a candidate for national office that you thought, this is the one, this is really the one?
Well, unfortunately, we don't ask candidates whether they are going to address this problem. And that's something that needs to be happening regularly, not only for the president, but for all of our representatives. What are you going to do to address this problem? So I really can't judge any of the candidates because we haven't gotten there yet. We haven't even made it part of the conversation in our elections yet. And until we do, we won't really know who is the best candidate unless we know that, you know, something about where they stand on the issue.
I want to move towards solutions now. You spend some significant time in the book talking about that. I'm going to ask you to read an excerpt from the introduction to Believing. Please go ahead.
The challenge of addressing gender-based violence is that the problem is complex, and any solutions will require more than technical skills. Gender-based violence is a global phenomenon. According to the United Nations Secretary General's report on violence against women, gender-based violence takes many forms: physical, sexual, psychological, and economic, that are interrelated and affect women from birth to old age. And over time, like viruses, patterns of violence evolve and new forms emerge. It drains resources from public services and employers and reduces human capital formation, making it a business problem as well as a social problem. It can ravage survivors' health as well as thrust them into poverty. It has infiltrated politics and disrupted workforces, schools and universities, and communities all at once.
I picked that because of the scale, the scope that you are putting a stake in the ground about. What would it take to address the problem on the scale that you're arguing it exists?
Well, you know, first of all, you have to acknowledge that a problem exists. And then once you acknowledge, you invest in measuring it, because you can't fix what you haven't measured and acknowledged. And so we can start there with a leadership commitment to do this. And I'm not talking just about leaders in Washington. I'm talking about leaders in our colleges and universities, in our local school districts, in our police departments around the country. All of this leadership needs to be involved in the solution, because the problem is evident in all of those institutions.
Anita Hill is University Professor of Social Policy, Law, and Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies at Brandeis University. She's also the author of the new book, Believing, Our 30-Year Journey to End Gender-Based Violence. Professor Hill, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.